Hi everyone, you're watching M4G Advocacy Media. Welcome to the Journey Series podcast season 4. And today we're here with Piper Hudson, who's going to tell us more about her journey and her family's journey through neurodiversity. But first, I'm Mark, a brown man with black and white beard, black glasses, I'm bald. And today I'm wearing a blue shirt.
And I'm Crystal. I have brown hair and brown eyes. I have on a black and white shirt and black glasses.
And we're in our home office. And today we're speaking with Piper Hudson, who's going to tell us about her family's journey and her journey through neurodiversity. Hi, Piper.
Hello, thank you for having me. Piper Hudson, I am a Caucasian late 30s cisgender female. I have my hair in a braid crown today with a purple flower to keep me hopeful for spring. And I am wearing a royal purple top with a Victorian collar. Today I am at home in what I was lucky enough to be my office. I follow a Maximus style, so there is lots to look at behind me. And I'm thrilled to be here today because every time I get to talk with you, it teaches me things about my own brain. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for joining us. Yes, so feel free to tell us about a bit about your journey.
So my journey understanding neurodiversity is rather new because I came at it first from an American parent standpoint. I have an 8-year-old incredible son, Bishop, who is autistic, and it took us quite a while to understand outside the American medical framework that is presented to parents when they discover that their child doesn't fit into the normal educational model. It can be very scary without a lot of information. So we started our journey, as many parents do, worried that there was a deficit in our child, that something was wrong, that we were outcasted. My husband cried. I really didn't understand, probably disassociated in the beginning because I had no framework to understand it. We were incredibly fortunate that the moment he entered school, the teachers put him on an IEP. Again, I think it's unfortunate that until you walk into that situation, you have no framework. So IEPs were very new to us. The school system was very kind in helping us really understand what it would take to assist with him being comfortable going to a public school, as he is vastly agoraphobic. His neurodiversity troubles often stem from a deep seated fear of his environments and social interactions within them. It takes a while to learn that in a kid until they can speak, and that's a maturity level that we had to ourselves understand. So as researchers, my husband and I both work at a university, and learning what we didn't know is how we processed the information. My husband was pretty quick to recognize some of the same patternings that our son struggled with. It wasn't until I got brain scans several years later that I got what I call the Rosetta Stone to my existence. I found out that I had a traumatic brain injury as a child that I was unaware of, and the parietal lobe on the right-hand side of my brain is severely dented. This changed everything in my world, from what I thought was happening in my brain, what were classified as panic attacks, what the gamut of what I had believed was occurring. And we used as much lived experience knowledge as we could to apply to helping our son, and saw drastic changes. Our understanding of blood flow and the delicacy of neurons in the human brain became very aware the more we tried to mitigate or assist some of the harder life challenges for us. My son and I, very easily triggered nervous systems. So nervous system work and somatic work and breathing became kind of essential to just our existence. We still struggle with that. I also have Lyme disease that I got as a teenager. I've been fascinated. The more neurodivergence I meet, the more had this ability to immediately recognize something was wrong. So I went running in a bike path, saw a dot, convinced it was Lyme disease. So it was caught very early. The extent really is just a lot of extra nerve damage in the hands and the feet. But because I have a brain damage that can't process sensory information, it is very hard to connect my mind and body to not have what I call a cognitive shutdown. That's a term we've tried to overtake with meltdowns, because meltdowns is not really something we understand in our house, because we don't, as my daughter say, but we don't melt into a puddle like a witch. I'm like, you're right, we don't. So identifying the different states of our nervous system, each one of our family members seems to react differently. One wants to fight, one wants to flee, one wants to fawn, one wants to freeze. So it took deep investigative work on my own brain scan results, because no one was really willing to walk me through what all this meant for how I enter into the world. Doing the research led me to learning so much more about my very unique family, and led me to meeting all of these people like yourselves that have given me a passion to understand my brain that I'm grateful I now have. So that's the shortened version of the very unique kind of traumas that occurred to create the space of understanding that we are fortunate enough to have.
Right. It is so amazing. There's definitely been some wonderful advances in understanding, especially when you have multiple disabilities. But if you don't fully understand the multiple disabilities and how they interact with the internal self and how that can affect your, like you were talking about, the cognitive shutdown and the nerves, the neuropathy, just a bunch of different things. We talked previously about the different senses that you find hard to be able to take in. And that is so interesting at how a lot of people that turns into something they weren't aware of, so they may find a bit because it wasn't understood. Disability as a whole is misunderstood, and that turns into ableism and manipulation and gaslighting, and it's a terrible thing to deal with. And I can speak from experience, but I've met so many people like yourself, that have dealt with the same thing. And Mark and I this morning were watching a series. It's called Unlearning Ableism. And I mean, even for ourselves, psychologically, that plays a huge part on the disability community as a whole, and having to unlearn those things so that we can be our best selves and go forward with things.
Yes, the unlearning, and it's its own encyclopedia. So the frustration of being aware of the ableism, I spent the first 5 years of our journey with our son being in the ableist bucket, only assuming everything they told me was the correct way to consider it, because they were the individuals who were supposed to know everything. So I was beyond grateful that my own understanding and self-awareness with my brain scans coincided with meeting a autistically proud female neurologist at Stanford at a conference. And It was one of the first times in my life where I was having a conversation and enjoying it. And I realized at that moment, like, okay, well, self-identification makes sense if you are feeling in a kinship immediately that no one else expresses. And she began, because she works with a lot of individuals who are wide-ranging, what Americans would call as intellectually disabled. And I was quite confused for her to say that in a status of being so proud herself of her identity, and found that kind of discrepancy that can, to me, be satiated through diversity. So that understanding and that social kind of paradigm concept where we are not a deficit system from an ideal type, we are just another variant in the human brain due to our human experience. And that was so relieving to me, and made so much sense immediately to me that the term neurodivergent, when I began researching it, immediately fit and felt comfortable. So it's interesting to see in the space there are those who are trying to find other terms or don't feel comfortable with that one. But I was very profoundly impacted by what you said, all these intersectionalities. There's so much. Like when I started cataloging the different diagnoses I'd received over the years due to what I now know was important information, it creates like this plethora and this existence of, well, do I have a hearing issue or am I one of the very many neurodivergents that find an auditory processing delay or difference? And it's not that I can't hear, it's that my brain has so many other sensory signals being imported at all times. It goes, well, auditory is not that important to you. So when I started meeting people who said, oh, well, you know, my husband and I have trouble because I can't listen and I need some hearing tests. And oh, I always hear it later. I'm like, you hear it later? I hear it later if I'm trying, that the cognitive load theories started making so much sense to me. Well, no wonder I'm having trouble hearing if I'm already maxed out. And that is what led me to understanding that my brain actually suppresses smells because it doesn't seem as necessary since being a mom, usually 80% of your smells are not going to be pleasant. So I've kind of lost my olfactory abilities recently, hoping I get them back whenever I'm away from the kids for a while. So those senses, and it got me wondering, well, dementia patients and Parkinson's patients, what if we just, instead of considering people by their diagnoses, considered their sensory profiles? And that's when I got the honor of discussing aesthetics with Morgan Harper Nichols, who is a exceptional Black female autistic digital artist who also has a neurodivergent son, and her son seems in chromoscapes. So his brain reduces his intake of color stimuli. And having art kind of be my whole point into the human existence when everything else didn't make sense, art always let me know that there was a connection I could make in the world. I became obsessed with wondering how does that apply in the art space? And that's what led to my research on sensory experiences in museums and neurodivergent aesthetics.
That all sounds amazing. No, it's kind of, we've made a lot of progress as a species in a lot of ways, but looking back in history at all the great artists we've had and all the unique perspectives they had, it's unfathomable to think we didn't see this before. But I mean, it's like it's the state of the world where people get denied and gaslit and all that other stuff and isolated. In some ways, they had a lot more freedom back then because of the lack of connectivity to the rest of the world. just out in cabin somewhere doing their thing, right? And but still, we have a lot of great blessings today that they didn't have back then. But in
That's true. For some of the many privileged, I will have to point out it has occurred to me, and my master's thesis led into the considerations of the femme fatale and the existence of women with a neurotype that likely led to hospitalization, victimization, sexual abuse, institutionalized. So I find the concept of hysteria in the Victorian sensibility absolutely fascinating, because I have no doubt that if I was in another time period, I would be locked up quite immediately if I told
For
anyone what
sure,
was going on in my
yeah.
brain. So we are finally at a point where I'm grateful that people are listening to these experiences. As we wrote our book on the synesthesia research that we were doing, it was interesting to note that just 5 years ago, some of the material we were using that was considered like the root texts were saying, well, hopefully someday science will recognize this and things like that. And we've come so far with being able to neurologically see what kind of connections are impacting our optics and all of the biofeedback that's occurring now, which may be scary in a privatization way, but is also liberating in the possible self-awareness information that we could gain for those who struggle with connecting their brain and their body and their emotional states to being in this neurotypical, agile experience.
It's totally changing now, but know that for a long time it's been about some doctor or some researcher who went to some university and is doing this bit of research and will only accept certain people into a study, and therefore the research gets kind of biased. And then people go and read that and think that's the truth and don't listen to actual patients about their experiences and tell them, no, I know what the actual situation is, and you don't know anything because you didn't go to school.
I still have a significant struggle when it comes to self-advocating for prescriber assistance. Right now, there is such a drastic ADHD medication shortage, and the difficulty for those who have found something that worked for them that is now out of their toolkit, and then to be experiencing other medications to try to supplant when they had their neurotype aligned. That's something that I'm finding extremely difficult, not only personally, but when I meet other individuals who now have a scarcity mindset against using the medication that helps them. It really concerns me when there's that kind of medical ability to alter or not believe what someone needs in order to thrive. And I know you know that oh so well.
It is really frustrating, especially when people know that something can help them, and they're judged and they're not heard or not listened to. Sorry, they're not listened to or respected because maybe they're minority, or they're a woman. There's a number of di certainly disability too, but there's a number of things, and if you're all of those things, can you imagine? It's so hurtful
And
to think
then,
about.
yeah, definitely. And then you take that to the extreme where someone's just been traumatized by whatever they're going through and just constantly dismissed and gaslit, or not even provided the same opportunities to get healing. They end up in the prison system, right? And it just ends up happening over and over again.
And
It
nothing
becomes a
because of
cycle of
anything.
destruction.
N nothing that they did wrong. It's just a systematic process that over and over and over again we're gonna have, and you're like, have we learned anything? And it's Bill
And I
Barton.
really didn't realize how blind I was to it, being a middle-class white woman who has a 19th century British art history background and lived in a little bit of a bubble while I was over there, and had that socialized medicine understanding of the need for art prescription, of the requirement of going for walks to breathe. And that's where our research for the sensory integrations in museums really started, because I was seeing, oh, they're using sensory maps or they're using digital twins. And I kept wondering, well, if I, my husband pointed out a scrapbook where he goes, you know, all the materials that they're saying you need, you print out and create in this ridiculous little glossy travel guide. And I was like, well, yeah, I do that so that I'm fully prepared and my nervous system isn't as scared. He's like, well, what if that's the status quo? And so he instituted a digital twin for historic sites that have the issue of being in war-torn areas, and digital twins for these amazing medieval Italian churches they went and they scanned, for the access alone. Accessibility to people who could never go there, who could never afford to, who it creates a wonderful inclusion method by simply letting people see your space. And I am often inspired by those who have open resources and share all their materials to show what's working versus what we see often in other institutions within the states that kind of hoard all of the great tools that could be helping other people.
Exactly. We spoke with a guy last week,
I was
actually.
just gonna bring that
We spoke with a guy. He works with Aroma Prime that talked about this sensory map and how the experience is for everybody to be included in amusement parks or like theaters or any kind of entertainment or certain,
right,
still
theme park
other things. You
rides
need
and things.
media and
Ooh,
stuff like that.
which one of my favorite ideas, that in a dream world, I would work for a company that would just tell me a problem and then I could make some ridiculous idea out of it. Like,
Right,
that's the
right.
dream job I'm searching for. I pitched to a local zoo that the best thing that they could do for families like us that typically don't even make it to certain parts because we have meltdowns over food, over exhaustion, is to track the difficulties that people have on site in order to then accommodate with shade pavilions or gamification of sites to assist people to watch their nervous system and not overextend themselves. So the idea that an institution cares enough about the visitor to include their mental and emotional and physical well-being by helping them navigate through the space. I love seeing institutions doing that.
Yes, I was amazed by, well, him in general and what he's doing, what his team is doing. But it should be common practice. It should already be there. I mean, why are we having to explain to people how to treat people? It's kind of, sad, but.
It can be, but we have to keep our chins up because it's just something that has to happen, whether we like it or
And
not.
you're right, we're in the best place. We've come drastically in the experience of where autism was just a Silicon Valley rich, white, angry genius concept. So the fact that we can even break these stereotypes to have the considerations of different neurotypes outside of that, we've come far. We've still got a lot of room to grow, but these
Yes, we
conversations, I
do.
think, really impact and connecting with different neurodivergence. So when I first met you, Crystal, and we were having our conversation, and I mentioned my traumatic brain injury, and then your eyes lit up. Just the conversations to connect, we don't know oftentimes. I didn't know a vast amount of how to help my brain until I met someone who had some unusual connection and had figured it out. And I don't think we're going to be able to help kids who are transitioning, who are moving into colleges, or who are going out into the real world, unless we're able to kind of tap into that empathy and tap into the excitement that people can get when they feel seen.
And like you were saying, for me, I think we have this special ability to pick up on the people that get it. They just know they're in tune with and can understand what we're dealing with. And I felt that with you immediately. And then you said that, and I'm like, whoa,
And I think I really struggle oftentimes, especially when it comes to certain work environments, is that ability to feel connected and having almost a nervous system comfort and safety, what we're now recognizing in the corporate world as psychological safety. It's impossible to have ideas and be open and excited if someone is not going to listen to what composes your existence.
Or if they just shut you down and completely,
Yeah.
dismiss you.
I and a lot of us have that internalized thing going into the workforce, and it's become easier for me at least to understand that's not me, that's the company that has to change or whoever has to change. Yeah.
Yes, it is so interesting. I mean, it's an awesome thing that companies are wanting to invest in DEI. But a lot of times they are completely disregarding disability and inclusion in that way. And it is really sad. So I have really been focusing and watching a lot of these DEI trainings and stuff, and it's so sad to see that when a company is all out and trying to put everything in their, into doing this, but then they're missing that.
Yes, it is the elephant in the room
frustrating.
when you see companies who are drastically promoting the ability to be centers where these people can find solace, only to discover that it's within certain pockets. It's not universal. The kind of company culture that you would assume would extend doesn't go throughout. I am grateful that neuroinclusion is a topic that some companies are aware of and are trying to strategize into their DE&I, but of course, DE&I is right now a hot topic where there are two sides, and many people don't understand unless they're on the other side why it's important. And we're still kind of having to remind people that it's a universal experience that we should all be sharing.
Right. And the other facet of that, I think, is being able to decipher when a company from the get-go never intended for there to be inclusion. And that's how they're making their money, and that's how they don't want change. And then there are those that do see the issue, do see things that could be better for the company, and they do want to make those changes. And those are the kind of companies that if you see them trying and they're just missing a portion of it, then you have hope still that they're going to put that in there. The other ones are not going to do anything.
Now, I love seeing the true flagships like Microsoft. I'm constantly amazed,
For
and
sure.
their inclusive design toolkit to then add cognitive load. I remember when that came out, I started contacting every accessibility person I knew because I very naively assumed that would be like the Bible of obviousness of why everyone else should consider neuro design.
You
And then spent the next year wanting to cry when when I got in trouble for asking all those questions. So I completely understand, and I fear for the neurodivergent workers looking for employment and finding kind of the man behind the curtain doesn't actually care about your neurobiology at all.
Right,
So that is
right.
definitely a struggle.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we can, in the spirit of inclusion, if we can go back a bit. You mentioned on your son's journey, he was one of the sports he benefited from was an IEP. Does that stand for Independent Education Partner?
Forgive me. So it's and I may not. It's an individualized plan, education plan. So
Okay.
when you have a child that they've identified as not being up to the normal standard of social interaction or other behavioral, they put you on a specific plan that divides the time up with assistive teaching helpers. For my son, transitions. As I learned, the more he discussed the fear of transitions is apparently a family attribute. The difficulty with moving to places that are unknown is incredibly debilitating for him. So IEP allowed for a transitional helper when he had to shift into school. He entered into kindergarten during COVID, so went in
Oh,
with
wow.
that scared,
Oh.
nervous state that nobody talked about a global pandemic being a global trauma. So he entered into a very new environment with a comfort level of masks, and he wears hood up, arms covered, legs covered, because he doesn't feel safe in environments outside our home. If he had the pandemic he loved, we were all stuck in one place, everyone he loves. So he doesn't understand the necessity to leave the house and then
Yeah.
to move rooms and then to go to recess and then to come back inside and then to move rooms again. And I understand for a child, that's a lot of transition. So his emotional exhaustion from the environment, and that's another thing I find deeply interesting in the neurodiversity space, is that I came into it not feeling disabled. I am disabled when I'm in an environment that is not aware or mindful of sensory needs. And so I often struggle being in this American disability space when I'm like, well, I don't know if I'd call my son's autism a disability, but I would call, our brain shutting down a disability. So it's hard to find that kind of comfort level between American medical situations and self-awareness and self-care. So the IEP allows him individualized time when his nervous system is shot. And we became aware of that only through being told how much time through the IEP, letting us know how he was doing. They were the standard guidelines of how much time in the classroom, how much out. But for a
Right.
parent, we had no knowledge of what an IEP meant, and it was a completely clueless time for us that showed the necessity for other neurodivergent parents
But
to
as
at
a
least
parent, you just,
lifeline.
yeah, you, as a parent, you just do what your child needs, you know.
When I became aware of corporations funneling specific neurodiversity programs, I got really excited and deep dived to learn about accommodations. I was on a bunch of presentations before I was even aware accommodations existed. So I got really excited about being in the space before I understood the difficulty level of what it takes to understand accommodations, be self-reflective enough to know what to ask for, to be self-advocate enough to then keep asking. So it's been a slow process of discovering how companies could be more neuro-inclusive. For me, it seems laughable, but asking for things in writing altered how I felt walking into a Monday, like knowing that I may have forgotten something or might not catch up, but having written notes wasn't something that I'd received for the first 12 years that I worked at a corporation until I learned that that was a very common accommodation request, which felt very frustrating to me, that asking for written guidelines or deliverables or agendas could be seen as something that had to be asked for was very hard in the initial progress.
It is really hard. And I feel like that's why a lot of disabled people are now working from home. They can make their own lists and they don't have to feel bad asking for it. But when, as we said before, when a company is invested in understanding those things and offering those things without making you feel bad for it, then it's a very big step forward in including and the inclusion in the disability community back in their businesses instead of the latter, you know, working for ourselves.
And positivity. It yeah. seems so generic, a choice to try and promote, but I know that my brain is negatively biased because it's hardwired for error detection. And the more I kind of learned about that, it was fascinating to me that the capitalization of the autistic individual for the corporate world was to utilize that perfectly characterized identification and hyperactivity of OCD to find nuances and patterns. But I didn't realize that for a female, for a socialized female, if I'm not given an activity or an agenda or something to focus on, that negative bias and self-criticism goes inward. And I spent a majority of my life being so self-critical that it would cause additional health issues, that mm-hmm. it's amazing we don't consider how someone's neurotype is required to understand an employee. So mm-hmm. asking them, how do you learn? What's the best time to talk to you? Things mm-hmm. that others would consider obvious. And that's a big word that frustrates me that I find having to explain to people that obvious to a vast majority, it's as far as what I'm probably going to find. So right. for most people, there are 2 points and a line over. And then for the neurodivergent brain, there are 80 points around it. It might cross over with a wiggle to get to the same end. And I told my husband that I'm very hopeful with this kind of AI scarcity. AI has only and likely will only ever be trained on neurotypical information and history. So the scarcity of being overtaken by AI gives neurodivergence an almost safe space to be like, well, if they're ever going to look for ideas or innovation or differences within that status quo pumped material, neurodivergence are probably going to be the only one to supply it. So that's something that I'm hopeful the more opportunity to understand our experiences will show those hyper awesome moments of actually being perfectly utilized for innovation. So when everything else may fail, the confusion of knowing us could actually be the link towards innovation and help for others.
There's no telling where it's gonna go, but one thing is for certain that our neurodivergence is so unique and so different. It's going to be hard to figure out, you know, because there's not like a group of us, or not mildly, there's not like a group of us that they can collectively, you know, collect data on and make, you know, they can't do that.
Well, the
So
UK is doing pretty good. They even have institutions that have autism certificates where you can go and get degrees to understand. So their ability to have actual academic data has really changed in the last year to having that option of being able to find these neurodivergents. And there are several work assistance programs that also funnel that data. Of course, many who have PTSD and traumatic brain damage that makes them fearful of being categorized, because usually in history, being tracked for having something different is not always the best situation. I am hopeful that it will stay a positive identification process.
yeah, definitely want to hope that it's gonna stay there, go that direction and stay there. We'll see what you think.
Well, it looks like we're slowly progressing to allow people of different identities, like neurodiverse people and others, into spaces where they weren't previously allowed to live and work. And so I'm hopeful that in the coming years, they'll be able to have more influences over things that are happening, like AI and all that stuff. And
Right.
I guess we'll only be able to tell after it's already happened.
Yes. The it is very hopeful to see the executive rising of individuals who identify as neurodivergent. As we talked about earlier, there's still such a gap in underserved communities and minorities and socialized women, socialized as women, identifying as females. They have a unique opportunity for that intersectionality that we've talked about, because the option to consider neurodiversity is such a span, and the world itself being neurodiverse, and then someone being different and being neurodivergent from that. We are curious to know that a vast increasing percentage of those who identify as neurodivergent also neurify as gender fluid. And one of the studies that we're hearing from at other institutions is the possibility of neurodivergence having that rejection of societal expectations in its very nature of the identification of genders. So, not surprising that we would see that fluidity or questioning of a social construct within that subgroup. So, as society becomes more tolerant of these transitions in identity and gender, and kind of rising of the suppressed cultures over time, I'm hopeful there's no way it's not going to be connected with this group, with the intersectionality, to bring more awareness and insight into all those different identities.
I really hope that's the direction it goes in, because it's very much needed for humanity in general.
And there's still a large percentage of people that kind of want to take us backwards or to the way things were. And that's not something that works for us.
To their it's not to their benefit. We kind of talked about earlier, the companies that are, it's very evident, it's not in their best interest to be inclusive. They
No, it costs them money.
didn't start out, wanting to be inclusive. They purposely built their company that way,
On a lineage of non-inclusion, inclusive practices, yes.
And you can definitely tell which is which.
And it's ironic, actually, that businesses and other sort of systems of societal systems or religions or whatever systems of government in order for them to gain popularity and propagate and grow into the future, they have to be as open as possible because the more you exclude people, that pool of is limited. Eventually, you're gonna become extinct or whatever.
The moment you said that, all I could think about was how the Roman Empire understood that they didn't need to change the cultures, they didn't need to alter the people, they just kind of took dominion over their existence and called them Roman because the knowledge of having a vast and interchangeable kind of route of society was beneficial. It helped keep people happy to have their cultures and cultural identities.
Right.
And that's so interesting because the more and more the world realizes inclusion is the way to go. And to advance society, that's going to exclude the ones that don't want to be inclusive.
Right.
So if they're doing it to themselves, we're not doing it.
Yeah, we're not forcing you to like us. We're just hoping you'll listen.
All you have to do is look at all the people throughout history who forced people to try and like them, like the British Empire or the Catholic Church, or, and I mean, certain religions and things, there's nothing wrong with them, but they will, people will be naturally drawn to them if they don't try and beat people over the head with whatever it is that they're trying to sell.
It's amazing that we have to remind corporations that the kinder you are to them, the more likely their culture and employee satisfaction will benefit. And there's no better way to show you actually care about someone than listening to what created the very nature of their ability to function in the world, let alone in the environment that we have been placed as a requirement of having to survive through corporate culture. So
Right.
it's interesting to see an awakening of this knowledge, and I'm hopeful that companies will take that and be mindful of how to use it for the benefit of everyone instead of singling people out or continuing the idea of cloistering off those instead of making it an actual inclusion space.
And then we talked earlier about the fact that, everything, the ableism we experienced and the way people treated us or treat us or whatever, is sometimes their fault. They're not going to do, they don't want to, it's not in their best interest. But some people, they just have to be shown the right thing. And, but if you think about it, those people, those leaders or those corporations or whatever, societally told people that's how you treat disability. That's how you treat minorities. That's how you do, it, and it's frustrating because it's not society's fault that there's ableism. That's how they were told to do things. But it's frustrating that, especially when you're trying to explain it, as long as we have and other people, obviously, in the disability community. But if you over and over again try to explain it, and then still people, do the same thing over and over again. It's, it gets kind of, it's frustrating.
Absolutely. It reminds me that certainty and curiosity cannot coexist. So people who are certain that they understand what something means or what that particular word choice or diagnosis should represent as will not be able to look at that person as an individual and see them with curiosity and come to it with an open mind. So, yes.
Anything else?
Now, what are you working on right now?
So we just finished our second book. Our first one was Inclusive Smart Museums, and that was the desperate search to understand why UK museums were so great about understanding how to use these techniques and how we could be doing the same things with AI and the innovations and technologies. Our second book was on the static experience of neurodivergence and the representation of synesthesia. Right now, I am hoping to find something to fill my heart with.
Well, it's amazing that you have to definitely recharge and come up with, other interesting ways you want to help people, things like that. But you can't always be doing something.
The difficulty of having a neurodivergent husband who does not stop. His brain never recharges. If you,
right,
I think he's got
right.
46 publications right now.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'm actually nowhere near. I think I have a lot to live up with a partner, which is good and
wow.
bad. But I would love to have the consideration of a career move that could help me work more in this space. That I think that's really where my efforts are right now, to help with my mental health, to be excited about another project in the future.
So, how can people find your books?
The book has been released on Barnes and Noble and Springer first. They're both Palgrave and Macmillan. Amazon has like a coming soon, which I don't understand, but this is my first book. So I originally never would have thought that I would be capable of creating a book or want to. Until I started meeting other people who got excited about how could spaces actually make us feel safer. And so that's what I love when people reach out with. So LinkedIn is the only social I actively use, and that's the best place to authentically see the things I'm interested in.
Those books, are they available in audio as well?
Oh, that is a great, I'm so excited about that question. I have no idea. I need to find that out because you just gave me a like life goal of doing an audio for a book. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's always amazing, especially for myself. We talked before about sometimes I need to take in sensory things in different ways, when I'm not hearing things correctly.
Were you thinking Braille?
Braille! I just thought, how amazing would it be to have a book translated? So, that's exactly what I was thinking. Got so excited about. Sorry to interrupt you. My brain was just too
No,
happy.
That's okay. No. It's exciting to talk to people who've written books, to let them know that there's audiences out there that can be, experiencing what you want people to know. That's why you wrote your book, to get it out there, that knowledge and those experiences.
And you know what? I didn't check to make sure that our online digital version was accessible by screen reader. So I'm so glad we're having this talk.
And if you're interested in Braille, you might want to check out our second episode with Kristen Parker, who does Braille translations of printed material.
We can definitely connect you with that, or you
please
can watch that episode and get that. Yeah.
Yes, because a holy grail of mine is to get thorough instructions on Braille usage for museum and sculptural labels, because the angle, the material, the height of the dot, I have so many questions that no one has ever been able to answer for me. So yes, please, I would love to be connected with her.
Yeah, because our InfoG Advocate Media is not just about media, like as in what people think of media as being, but it's collecting and having these interviews and making the connections with other people so that things are more inclusive for our audience and your audience.
Knowledge media, knowledge increasing media. Like there needs to be a different term for it. And it's like positive media versus junk media.
Right. Yeah, we were thinking about that too. It's like when we were thinking of the name, it was like media kind of has a, in the past, it's had a negative connotation to it. So do we want to put that in there? But then it, what we want to do in the future is collectively put a bunch of people, you know, in the disability community and the allies, their media all on our site for resources for other people.
You could do media blocks where you have little snippets or informational videos that you could create collections for on your website that companies could use as inclusion material.
Yeah, definitely. We're trying to decide because we've recently had I don't want to go into all of the stuff, but we had a something where we're gonna get into and it be a collaboration. I guess will be the biggest way to say it, but it fell through, and so we're currently thinking of new ideas and new
It's
directions that
painful.
we
And
get.
I'm so glad that there is now neurology and they can actually realize that emotional rejection is read in the body, in the brain, as physical pain. And having things fall through and projects, or for me, I'm living in the job rejection letter. I think it's so essential to make more awareness of how that emotionally and physiologically affects us instead of just breezing over, like, obviously, it affected you to like a trauma level, and no one really allows that kind of vocabulary use these days when that's what it feels like for neurodivergent populace. Like, we feel friendship losses, like deaths internally, and
Yeah.
it's so heavy. So I'm sorry for your partnership loss.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely a process of kind of like when you first get your disability, like you said, your TBI came, you know, was discovered later. But you know, when mine happened at 18, it was like everybody disappeared. And other, you know, people make excuses why they couldn't exist in my world anymore, you know. And when things like that happen, it's kind of like, okay, is so I've learned how to, over the years, how to protect myself from people that do that to me, you know. And so when things like that happen, I understand things happen and they can't collaborate like they were wanting to, you know. I get that.
Yep, I have
But
a post-it note. What if you didn't care about what happened of their opinions of you? Because
right.
I would love to bring more awareness to the full emotional weight that is experienced in individuals who have neurological changes for how deeply impacted they are by these social interactions. That was one of the things I mentioned early on to a friend of mine is if I have a big meeting cancel and have no explanation, my brain is going to fixate on that to the point where I'll probably become sick or get a cold because my immune system is weakened by my stress over something that shouldn't matter. So I know there's so many women out there living in that existence.
And what's funny about that is the older we get, the less we're able to fight that, those symptoms of those that might sound little to most people, but we are not able to hide it off as much. And they make, like, I was explaining it to you that we have ataxia. And those things actually make our symptoms a lot worse, where our speech gets worse, our eye movements get worse, our walking gets worse. So, I mean, it's, yeah, it manifests differently in all kinds of disabilities, but yeah, it's interesting.
And that's, and I'll have to go back and look at that because, again, I find it fascinating the neurological connections that explain things that we are assuming are our own faults, is a easy way to begin the conversation of self-care when you are mad at your brain for an extended period of time.
And not only that, but if we think about also the medications that solved one issue but gave us like 200 other issues.
Gene testing. I didn't know until this year when my psychiatrist was like, "Hey, you want to get a gene test to see what your body finds irritable in medications?" And I was like, "Excuse me? This is something I can do." And sure enough, the report came back that 80% of the things I've been on in the past would register as having a reaction in a negative fashion, and the validation that can be used with thoughtful medicine.
Everything Amazon, same thing. Yeah, so
And, there's also the things that nobody actively took for, but were just in the environment. When our parents were growing up and their parents, things like DDT were actively used and in the environment and other pollutants and things. And that,
Smoking 1950s. If you weren't smoking, you weren't cool.
and yeah, whatever they were throwing out their things and
And I've listened to some scientists, and they say things like, "Well, there's no way that can affect you today because that's not the way genetics works, right?" But then, if you understand what things we didn't think were real, we realize our common sense, and we know them to be actual facts now. How likely is it that they don't know what? I mean, their lot knowledge is limited. I mean, they can't know what they don't know.
Absolutely. And environments, not only in the way they affect you physically and mentally, but have that actual physiological change. One of our articles was on the integration of biophilic endeavors into environments to counter sick building syndrome. So I noticed that going back, I was feeling groggy and I was having other issues on top of my usual. And the decrease in oxygenation that I was having, not only from the stress level, but I work in a basement, had never been something I'd considered previously. After COVID, all of the plant services were taken out of the buildings for cost and return to office. And the more I recognize that hospitals and all these places have that integrated nature, not only for our nervous system, but so that we can actually breathe better. I get really upset when I'm in white-walled fluorescent spaces that are supposed to be camaraderie building and I can't breathe in them.
It is frustrating. It's like they know what we need, but they don't want to offer it all over. It's
One of the things we joked about for a corporate benefit is an oxygen bar. Like, everyone is not getting the proper amount of oxygen. TBI people have drastically limited oxygenation due to the passages within their brain. And an easy way to not only increase productivity, but having someone be healthier would be just an oxygen bar. And it infuriates me when I go and there's donut and there's all these sugar and horrible things for me. And I'm like, I just want some air.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. We could like go into a lot of, going back to the whole medication thing of the drugs that would solve one thing, but
and cause three more.
Yeah, 100 more. But, a lot of their thing was to cause this problem so that you have to take another thing and another thing and another thing, and it becomes very profitable to them and breaks everybody else. So
my dream world would have free brain scans for everyone. Just whenever they want it, they could just go. I think the amount of issues that are a direct result of not understanding your own neurology is why I started this work.
Right. Well, not just understanding our own neurology, but I mean, other people really caring about people's brains and wanting to help them understand how why they do what they do and how they act, why they act like they act.
I had a question in there, but I lost it over there.
Oh, goodness. So anything else you want to add?
I think that's it.
Oh, good.
Okay. Those are my happy projects.
Like I said earlier, we had a lot going on, but I think it, what was it, like 5 months ago that we talked last?
I don't think it was that long.
I think it might have been December, because I remember when I made the thing, I was like, I'm going to go deep into the new year.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll definitely get with you, and I'm sure we can have a lot more wonderful conversations.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much for joining us today, though.
Oh, my pleasure. My heart is happy with the ideas you've given me, so anytime. It was lovely.
Okay, thank you, Barbara.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
Bye. You as well.